This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
Daniela Gabor is Senior Lecturer in Economics at Bristol Business School. She wrote her PhD under Sheila Dow at the University of Stirling and is a specialist in the study of central banking, international financial institutions, political economy of macroeconomic policy paradigms and comparative economic systems. I've got that right. How could you be a specialist in four areas?
Well, I would say areas of interest rather than specialism.
Michael Kuczynski is Emeritus Fellow of Pembroke College here in Cambridge and was formerly in the research department of the International Monetary Fund. His interests include monetary and financial theory, the balance of payments, and international finance. And Michael's kindly agreed to give us an initial response to Daniela's talk in order to set the discussion going. So, over to you, Daniela.
Well, thank you, Mark, for the invitation and for the opportunity to speak here. It's a great honor. What I want to talk about today is the early period of transition in Central and Eastern Europe. I will mostly refer to the countries known as EU10, we can discuss whether the arguments also apply to the former Soviet Union. The background to this discussion can be related to the way that we understand transition now in very broad terms, and that is to distinguish between two different phases of transition. And I've taken this distinction from an IMF working paper by Fabrizio et al. And the first period describes, known as the first transition, is supposed to be a period of great disruptions in the post-plan period that have been marked by industrial contractions. There was very high and volatile inflation, high unemployment, output collapse, and that's supposed to have lasted up to around 1995, 96, when we move into a second transition, when policymakers that have had previously been confronted with the policy challenges of such structural change from a centrally planned model to a market-based economy, they managed to overcome some of these challenges, and we have this idea that now Eastern European countries were very successful, at least until the collapse of Lehman Brothers, in harnessing globalization with a well-defined development model. And for in this paper, there are two distinct grounds for this development model. One is a very benign attitude towards international financial integration, and one of the manifestations of that is the very important presence of foreign-owned banks, mainly Western European, in domestic banking sectors, and a benign tolerance of real exchange rate appreciation. And for purposes of comparison, that's very much in the line of Latin American countries in the 1980s and is usually contrasted with the East Asian development models that have a more cautious attitude towards international finance and the strategy of undervaluing the exchange rates. And this second transition is used to explain, or this development model is used to explain what has happened to Eastern Europe after the collapse of Lehman Brothers in September 2008. If you're familiar with the trajectory of the region since 2009, around February we had this report appearing in the Daily Telegraph that called Eastern Europe the subprime region. They pointed to the foreign-owned banks in Eastern Europe and to the exposures to cross-border lending and funding distress to say, this is a moment that could have consequences that go even further than the collapse of Lehman Brothers for the international financial system. And what I want to argue today is that this idea that the second transition has and the development choices of the second transition have shaped the vulnerabilities of Eastern Europe do not reflect the fact that the policy choices in the first transition, in the first period of transition, are very important to take into account. In other words, that the second transition model didn't emerge spontaneously out of a sort of generalized realization of what the policy priorities should be, but they are a continuation of the choices that have been taken in the first period. And in order to argue that, I will look at a particular field of the macro of the transition model and the distinguish between stabilization, liberalization of markets, and privatization of state-owned enterprises. And I would look at how macroeconomic policies for stabilization were discussed in the early period. And I will look particularly at the dominance of excess demand narratives, the idea that formerly planned economies suffer from excess demand stemming from particular characteristics of the productive sector and of consumption in under the central plan. And I will use a contested narrative approach in order to argue that the first period of transition is very important to understand the Europe's trajectories. And I will show, I'm borrowing from the literature on policy narratives, the idea of contested policy narratives, and I'll show how the excess demand narrative traveled from a very debated issue in the academic world before 1989 or before the collapse of socialist planning, and it became a consensus in the post-1990 discussions of what to do about stabilizing transition. And then I will try to give an answer of why this journey was important, because it entered the IMF's policy advocacy, and IMF, I focus on the IMF because it was a very important policy actor during the early 1990s. Jeffrey Sachs, for instance, or Ricardo Portes argued that the IMF had a very important leverage in policy negotiations. For a variety of reasons, because it's the international institution in charge of balance of payment problems, and most formerly planned economies did have important balance of payment problems, and also because they didn't have much access to private international financial markets, so they were forced to rely on the IMF conditionality over and over again. I will also argue that this dominance of excess demand narratives is very important for the way that the restructuring of the bank of the state-owned banking sector happened in Eastern Europe, and I will provide an alternative account of stabilizing transition. So try to deconstruct the way that the narrative of excess demand was built, and try to argue that with a different narrative that is focused on the stabilization of the industrial sector and on industrial restructuring, we would have had a very different outcome for Eastern Europe. And in the paper, I make it clear that I'm not. The paper doesn't try to explain sort of yearly variations in macroeconomic output, or try to attribute sort of all hegemonic importance to the excess demand narrative. The extent to which it shaped policy choices in individual transition countries depended a lot on the configurations of domestic politics in that country. So, in that sense, it's just a sort of general argument about the importance of the excess demand narratives in international policy discourse. So what is financialization? It's an emerging field of interest. It started as it's a very interdisciplinary pursuit. It started in the critical accounting school, looking at the rise of shareholder value associated with the work of Julie Froude or Carol Williams from the Manchester School of Critical Accounting. It also appears in sociology related to the financialization of everyday life. You can find also arguments in political economy from Jerry Epstein or Jane D'Arista arguing or describing financialization as the increasing importance of financial actors and financial practices. And a more recent contribution from Matthias Vernengo shows that inflation targeting regimes have been have worked to serve the interests of financial capital as opposed to or in the detriment of industrial capital and labor. The concept that I'm using in this paper is borrowed from James Crotty, this idea of impatient finance, that we move away from long-term provision of finance to the productive sector into sort of short-term portfolio choices, a same kind of definition that Hardy and Howarth used in their 2009 paper to describe the financialization of the banking sector in the European Union. And recent research has also linked the financialization with sort of most post-structuralist concerns with language and the idea of narratives. And narratives are described as mobilizing accounts that frame a crisis or a policy problem and that legitimize a particular response that serves sectional interests. So no policy problem is conceived on very objective grounds, but it comes from particular political or ideological interests. And there are a couple of papers that have been written about that. For instance, Engelen et al. Describe or compare the pre-crisis celebration, or narrative celebration of financial innovation that had an impact on the way that we've, on the governing regimes of international finance, with a post-crisis proliferation of lots of different narratives of why financial system had to be reformed. And they argued that this proliferation of competing narratives has actually impeded or has made it difficult to come up with a singularly convincing idea of how we could reform finance. For Holland, Albers et al. Argued that if you look at the way that securitization processes happened in Holland, private sector actors managed to convince or frame the securitization as a beneficial process, and central bankers and regulators didn't have an alternative narrative that could articulate convincingly an idea of why securitization would be a bad thing. So then that contributed to how securitization regulation happened. So in this perspective of trying to look at competing narratives, also treats the policy terrain as a contested terrain, something very much in the line of Jerry Epstein's idea that monetary policy is a contested terrain where you have hegemonic and counter-narratives that come together, and the hegemonic narrative would be very influential in structuring particular policy choices. And in Eastern Europe, that hegemonic narrative in the early period of transition came from initially the Polish experiments with limited marketization. Poland in the 1980s tried to move a bit away from this central planned form of allocating resources to state-owned enterprises, and they were faced with problems of shortages and inflation. And for the IMF, what that meant is that any program of transformation from the centrally planned system to the market-based system has to put macroeconomic stabilization first. And this is a quote from Thomas Wolff, who was head of the IMF's Eastern Europe division at the time. And a variety of papers that are associated with the IMF identify three different concepts that are relevant to the stabilization problem in transition. One is the soft budget constraint that was introduced and developed by Janos Kornai, a Hungarian economist that argued under the planned system, enterprises do not operate like companies would do in a capitalist system, but they are not constrained by price, by demand, but they are not disciplined by the market, but on the contrary, they very much depend on targets set by planners, and planners wanted always to overfulfill targets because it looked good when you had to report them to your Minister of Finance. So there was always an incentive to produce more without any constraints from the pricing side. The second concept that was relevant there, and I will discuss in greater detail further on, is the idea that all formerly planned economies had an excess of liquidity or unspent purchasing power in the household sector, and that was called a monetary overhang. The third relevant problem for stabilization was the idea that exchange rates were severely misaligned, and it had to do with the fact that there were pervasive exchange rate controls under the planned system, and with the efforts to move to a market-based approach would need to address these. So the excess demand narrative looked like this. The idea was that in order to move to a market-based system, you needed prices to function or to offer signals for resource allocations. That meant that you had to give up the centrally planned way of where planners set prices, so you had to quickly adopt the policy of price liberalization. in the presence of excess demand that comes both from this idea of excess household liquidity, but also the way that enterprises have incentives to produce, to keep producing, and without any price constraints, this price liberalization might be transformed into an inflationary spiral. So the idea was all countries in the formerly planned system should adopt a mix of tight monetary, fiscal, and income policy in order to ensure that macroeconomic stability would allow for a greater transformation of the economies in question. Okay, so so what we had here is a strange consensus emerging in the transition debate. And for those of you who are familiar with the early literature on transition, a very intense debate arose around questions of sequencing. And we had two opposing camps, one called the shock therapy camp and the other one the gradualist camp, that debated how what was the adequate sequence of moving to a market-based system. In the sense of should you stabilize first or should you liberalize first or should you privatize everything, and for the shock therapy people, everything had to come at the same time. So the plan system suffered from such profound structural problems that only a big bang approach would ensure that new that the system of incentives would move towards a market-based system. For gradualists, they said, look, shock therapy people don't understand that markets have an institutional dimension, and with that institutional dimension, that means that you can't stabilize, liberalize, and privatize everything at the same time, right? The Washington Consensus Trinity. However, in this sequencing debate, there was very little questioning of the idea that formerly planned economy planned economies had to stabilize by containing this idea of excess demand. Even post-Keynesians participated in the debate, and they debated, my point is that they debated the outcomes rather than the diagnostics, so they didn't engage with the excess demand narrative either. The most famous book that came at the time was called The Market Meets Its Match by Alice Hamsden with Lance Taylor and somebody else I can't remember now. And they called they described the shock therapy versus gradualism debate as a moral crusade of market fundamentalism. So in the sense, market fundamentalism was there. And for post-Keynesians and structuralists, the idea was that we should focus the outcome not on arriving at a market-based outcome, but arriving at full employment. And they, of course, prescribed a very different set of policies of how you could achieve full employment once you move away from the full employment guaranteed by the centrally planned system. However, it's quite remarkable that in the debate, in the post-Keynesian take, there wasn't much questioning of the idea of excess demand and its equivalent, the fact that formerly planned economies suffered from repressed inflation. And that is just a rising excess liquidity balance that people or households hold with respect to what they would wish to hold if markets cleared at official prices, right? So there wasn't market clearing because formerly planned economies suffered from severe shortages. And I'm from Romania, and I was born under under the planned system, and I have very good experience and very well-developed skills of queuing. So, yes, the queuing was quite pervasive there. And my argument is that this consensus on excess demand actually stands very much in opposition to the pre-transition discussions about the macroeconomics of central planning. Whereas here we have a consensus that excess demand was pervasive in formerly planned economies, in the disequilibrium shortage debate, the opposite was happening. And I'll try to take you through that. The disequilibrium approach, so I'm going to look now at the macroeconomics of central planning, as discussed by first the disequilibrium approach that argue that comes mostly from the work of Ricardo Portes, and I don't know if he's English, but he was based in Birkbeck College, and he developed a set of models that try to formalize the question of whether centrally planned economies suffered from the same inflationary pressures as capitalist economies were going through in the 1970s. And he said, yes, there is lots of anecdotic evidence that in the form of queues, in the form of shortages, but we actually don't know unless we use formally testable models whether shortages are a pervasive phenomenon. And in order to do that, he made use of an emerging field of work called disequilibrium models that moved away from the Walrasian flexible price system towards the possibility that some markets don't clear because there is quantity rationing and price rigidities, as in the work of Barr and Grossman. Excuse me. And in those models, if there is quantity rationing and if there are price rigidities, then households or demand for all consumer goods are not satisfied, and then there is forced savings. And the households will hold these forced savings until there is a mechanism that clears the market, and then price is adjusting as a consequence of that. And for the work on for the centrally planned economies or for the macroeconomists that try to conceptualize what was happening in centrally planned economies, these disequilibrium models were very helpful because centrally planned economies were based on a very tight control of prices. And Portes and Winter developed models that specified two types of agents, one households and the other one was planners. So the planners were conflated with the industrial production sector. And two types of markets for labor and consumer goods, and they argued that also reflects two types of monetary circuits. One is the intercompany money, that is a sort of passive money that moves around and only reflects real decisions about the allocation of resources that are taken by planners, and these may mutate into active money once they enter the household sector. So the household sector had access to only bank deposits or cash, and they were paid wages from the from the intercompany monetary circuit. And they argued that we can think about this equilibrium in centrally planned economies as a temporary state of the consumer market that arises from the planner's inability to reach targets. And they made two very controversial assumptions that I will discuss in a I will discuss later why they were controversial. And one was that there was no systematic tendency towards imbalances. In other words, it can be that we have shortages in the centrally planned economy, but it comes from unintended planning or production errors. Okay, so the fact that you had to that a central planner had to balance all the sectors of the economy without very complex computers meant that planning errors were quite likely. However, in this model, they were correctable in the new planning period, so there was no systematic tendency towards imbalances. The second assumption that they made was to locate this equilibrium in the consumer market, and they said, okay, we might have planning errors in the industrial production sector, however, those planning errors will only manifest themselves in the consumption sector, for instance, because there are higher wage bills than originally envisaged by planners, or because there is some oversupply of consumer goods or demand for consumer goods. And they argued that, on the contrary, demand for intermediate inputs or investments doesn't contribute to this equilibrium. And then they show that with quantity rationing in the consumer goods market, we have the same process as in the typical disequilibrium models of moving to forced savings accumulating. And because this is a very basic financial system where there are no many portfolio choices, if you have a wealth overhang, then you have a monetary overhang. In other words, all the excess savings that you hold are very liquid. And then Portes and his co-researchers set to empirically test the model, and they found something very puzzling, that the centrally planned economies tended to switch between excess demand and excess supply states. In other words, there was no pervasive excess demand, but there were different states, and they did that for varieties of countries in Eastern Europe for the 1950s to 1970s. And this finding, particularly the last one about the discrete switchings between excess supply and excess demand, was very, very controversial, and it resulted in a very intense debate with a shortage school coming from the work of Janos Kornai with several other people. And they argued that basically this is the work of, I would call them Western economies that really don't understand the historical basis and the historical particularities of socialist production. And that socialist production is characterized by micro-level pervasive chronic shortages that have to do with the system of incentives in socialist production. And they said, okay, let's compare the way a firm works under capitalism than the one, than with a firm that works under a Soviet plan system. And under capitalism, the firm is profit-driven, is constrained by demand, is disciplined by the market. And in that sense, the disequilibrium school only replaced the market with a central planner and somehow assumed that the other principles governing the functioning of state-owned firms were very similar to the capitalist firm. However, Kornoy argued, when you look at the way that the Soviet production system is organized, what's happening there is very important to take into account the politics of planning. In other words, the firm is always trying, is quantity-driven, is always trying to overachieve its targets, and it's basically constrained by shortages because there were pervasive shortages of intermediary inputs, and it's always competing for resources with the other firms in the system. So what we have here is a very important managerial level dimension, in the sense that you have firms are more likely to achieve not because they're good and efficient in production, but because their managers are good at political negotiations with the planners. Okay, and that means that the soft budget constraint was pervasive in the industrial production sector, in the sense that costs were always validated by central panels to stimulate output. Okay. So with these different foundations of how firms operated under the Soviet plan, and then the discrete switching from excess demand to excess supply was impossible. And they also put forward a methodological critique in arguing that it's impossible to identify an aggregate supply or aggregate demand, as the disequilibrium approach did, since all the relevant processes are happening at the micro level. So to sum up, this in the disequilibrium versus shortage, and this is a very short version that I've given here, the disequilibrium approach viewed disequilibrium as a macro phenomenon that was empirically testable, and they demonstrated that you could have excess supply or excess demand at the discrete points in time, whereas for the shortage approach, disequilibrium was a question of managerial decision taken at the micro level. And one of the shortage economists, David Kem, argued in 1989 that there are few tenets of the economics of centrally planned economies which are more likely to cause disagreement than the notion that centrally planned economies suffer from chronic excess demand or shortages of goods and services. So by the time that communism fell, this was the accepted view in academia, that somehow there is no way to resolve this debate between the shortage school and the disequilibrium school. And then the question that I'm trying to answer in the paper is, how come that from this highly debated and unresolved conflict that we had before 1989, we have moved towards an increasing consensus that in order to stabilize formally planned economies, you had to contain excess demand. And I argue that has to do with the way that the IMF standard stabilization policies worked. And They were basically known as financial programming, where inflation or balance of payment problems were narrated as a issue of excess demand. Research usually associates financial programming with monetarist ideas about the economy. And what the IMF usually prescribed was exchange rate devaluations, and in order to make sure that these exchange rate devaluations hold in real terms, in order for these devaluations to be effective, financial programming usually impose contractionary criteria for central bank credit and for government spending and floor for international reserves. And Easterly gives a very interesting critique of the financial programming model. But the point is that these targets were calculated as residuals by setting a target for the money supply. So a very monetarist explanation of how to introduce discipline into a system that is characterized by excess demand. The question then was the challenge was how to take this standard stabilization approach, which many call the blueprint for interventions or one-size-fits-all approaches, how to translate that this policy model to the post-planned context. And I argue that this happened by dovetailing, so taking from the debate between the shortage school and the disequilibrium school, the treatment of money as neutral in the disequilibrium school, and from the shortage school, the treatment of state-owned production as governed by the soft budget constraint. And to give you an idea of how the IMF economists thought about formerly planned economies, I've taken this quote from Allen and Haas, who and their paper is entitled the Transition from the Perspective of Two IMF Country Representatives, and they're making it very clear that there was a convincing work at play in order to shift national authorities' ideas about how to control prices from what I would say is a structuralist view of price control towards becoming a monetarist, right? And the idea was that tight monetary policy was designed to make the cost, the markup pricing policy impossible. And they also tried to dismiss arguments about the velocity of money being unstable, that arguments that you can trace back to monetarist post-Keynesian debate. Okay, and so how this consensus was constructed first by looking at or by taking from the disequilibrium approach the treatment of money and the references to excess liquidity, and they argued even for shortage economies they argued that the conceptualization of money was probably the best thing that the disequilibrium approach could contribute to the debate. And they said, okay, passive enterprise money becomes active through the wage channel, and that will feed excess demand. And so we can argue for excess household liquidity even if we don't have the sort of aggregate excess demand that disequilibrium schools discussed. So what you find in the early literature and early policy documents on Central and Eastern Europe are these estimates of the monetary overhang, it's another way of saying excess liquidity, and they were done by comparing an equilibrium broad money to GDP ratio to the current broad money to the GDP ratio. And then it's very interesting that they came out that for very different countries, and there are lots of studies doing that, around 40 or 50% of liquid imbalances were involuntarily held. In other words, 50% of the existing liquidity was unspent purchasing power, and the moment that you liberalize prices, that would trigger an inflationary spiral. However, on its own, the existence of unspent liquid balances wasn't necessarily a problem, because you could say, well, price liberalization would absorb that. So you have a one-off spike in prices, but then why do you still have to have tight monetary policies as a guideline for policy formulation? And they argued that, okay, we need to take also into account the shortage treatment of state-owned firms. And we have to have tight monetary policy because we need to discipline state-owned enterprises into hard budget constraints. If we don't, what's going to happen is that we will see relationships inherited from communism continuing in transition, in the sense that banks, state-owned banks, will continue to feed the soft budget constraints that firms had before the collapse of communism. Okay. So, how is this important? Well, I argue in the paper, and I'm now going to hurry up a bit, this construction of the consensus is important because once stabilization programs came into place, we had different framings or the underlying assumptions of the excess demand narrative were consistently used in order to explain why we had policy failure to be attributed by the central bank to factors other than the monetary policies that stabilization policies were prescribing. The first frame to take into account, I argue, is the fact that inflationary pressures were located or described as a demand pressure, right? And that functioned to sideline the cost push pressures that could appear once the economy moved towards a liberalized system with flexible exchange rates. And it's the idea that there is excess demand has been contested from a variety of approaches. For instance, if you have pervasive informal markets, then the excess liquidity or the forced savings that households have can be spent very quickly. It's also possible that you have voluntary savings because you're not sure when consumption goods will come in and out of the market, so you want to make sure that you'll be able to purchase the goods that are coming out. And if you take a post-Keynesian view, you could say, well, even if you have an excess of forced savings under the plan system, the uncertainty of moving away towards from the planned system that comes with very important economic and social consequences would mean that people will treat money as a store of wealth, and they will have a higher liquidity preference in order to deal with this uncertainty. So it's not clear that forced savings would actually become unspent or will function as unspent purchasing power. The second argument that is important to consider is that cost push pressures were very important at the time because of the organization of socialist production. And I argue in the paper that the way that the socialist production was organized very much depended on exploiting economies of scale. And so we had very complex networks of vertically integrated large firms. I'm abstracting here, of course, in different national contexts there will be different configurations, but that was at least the logic of planning. And these exploitations of economies of scale meant that you couldn't substitute intermediary imports for anything else. So in that sense, any decisions or any price changes in a vertical chain would be very quickly transmitted through a domino effect. So the idea was then that cost push pressures and exchange rate policies should have been essential to macroeconomic stability, defined both in terms of the stability of the price level and in terms of redressing balance of payment imbalances. And the implications of this are that if policy had taken a different route of focusing on cost push pressure rather than excess demand, then we could have arrived at messy but possibly more effective solutions. And Russian economists and then some structuralist economists from the US discussed the idea of multifaceted price systems where you have different markets with different control prices instead of the across-the-board price liberalization that the IMF and some domestic policymakers proposed. And also, very, very importantly, instead of the typical financial programming, money-based stabilization, we would have had a much clearer focus on exchange rate stabilization. And, for instance, Jeffrey Sachs argues that countries would have avoided lots of the volatility in inflation and output if international donors and the IMF would have agreed to currency stabilization funds of the type that Poland had, but nobody else managed to put together. Because, and then this is IMF research, exchange rate stabilization, even in the IMF practice, is much more successful than money-based stabilization. And usually it happens with overshooting monetary targets. So very post-Keynesian argument about endogenous money. The second underlying assumption of the excess demand narrative was that the centrally planned system was a wage-led system, and that I trace back to this disequilibrium discussion on labor as the main input in production in this labor consumer goods model. And that came to ground a very restrictive income policy in order to maintain state-owned enterprises' costs under control. And this replicated some of the heterodox stabilization plans that the IMF took in Israel and Mexico. However, there is research that argues that, in fact, wages played a very, very small, well, not very small, but a relatively small part in the overall production costs because of the importance of the state in social provisioning. So the state provided health, education, housing, so these costs were not included in wages. And if that proposition would have taken seriously, then, of course, the magnitude of the monetary overhang wouldn't have been as substantial as initially calculated. And also, it was impossible to, or it was very difficult to use income policies in order to contain inflation. But I argue that the purpose of this in a sort of discursive way was to narrow the argumentative terrain around cost push pressures. the third and I think one of the most relevant ways that excess demand narrative framed the policy discussions in formally planned economies was the idea that this pervasive excess liquidity is important to take under control because of the importance of redefining the relationship between banks and state-owned enterprises. And for instance, the most radical proposals from McKinnon came emphasized the idea that it was impossible for banks to perform the kind of credit allocation decisions that are taken by under market principles because of large information asymmetries and because state-owned Soviet banks didn't actually do that. And instead of that, state-owned enterprises should be refused any access to bank lending, and they should be pushed towards capital markets. Even if research in Western capitalist countries showed that bank lending was the main source of external finance for most companies. And I argued that prioritizing rather than restricting the provision of liquidity to industrial firms should have been at the center of monetary policy narratives. And that is important because in terms of how a capitalist monetary of economy of production functions, but it's important also in terms of the relationship between central bank policies informed by the excess demand narrative and industrial restructuring. And there is evidence that in this first stage of transition, we had pervasive liquidity shortages, we had very high interest rates, and we had a transition version of endogenous money in the form of complex networks of credit relationships that arised outside the banking sector as enterprises extended credit to each other or bartered with each other. And they were called inter-enterprise arrears. And we also had liquidity problems for a variety of firms transforming into solvency problems that contributed to industrial collapse, and then, of course, because of deteriorating balance sheets, to banking crisis. The point is not that this has happened systematically, but that there was it was important for central bank liquidities to be coordinated with industrial policies. And for instance, this is a quote from one of the Polish former ministers of finance that argues that against the prevailing wisdom of trying to sever the link between between monetary policy and Polish enterprises or Polish industry, the key was to have an industrial policy. And this didn't happen that often because central banks often aligned to excess demand explanations. And I argue that's because that allowed them to defect or to move away from a policy responsibility for the large output contractions or inflation. Okay, and now coming to the probably more interesting bits. What's the relevance of this sort of obscure debate in the 1980s? Is that this has contributed to how we have viewed the reform of the banking sector in formerly planned economies. And the arguments that we find is that the recurring bank failures, and I have a long list of bank failures in the region, were due to the political validation of soft budget constraints and vested industrial interests. In other words, of the difficulties with breaking the soft budget constraint. And a very famous paper by Bergloff and Bolton argued that the consequence of that was the emergence of a great divide between the front runners like the Czech Republic, Poland, or Hungary, who had managed to move towards a market-based system, and the laggard countries that were plagued by a cycle of unpaid debt, enterprise arrears, pressures for monetization that resulted in inflation, worsening balance sheets, and then the argument that came at the end is, of course, then what that means is you shouldn't have state-owned banks, but what you have is you have to privatize your banking system. And the way that this financial reform was narrated, I argue, has had two discursive effects. It first put aside or sidelined the link between excess demand narratives and the liquidity shortages that state-owned enterprises suffered from in the first years of transition. And these are important, or the central bank is important then, because what we had in the first years of transition with inflation was financial disintermediation. In other words, people moved towards well, mostly dollar, because we didn't have euro at the time, and that meant that banks had less and less deposits to draw on in order to finance credit activity. So in order for banks to actually lend, they had to make use of central bank reserves, and if the central bank was informed by excess demand narratives, then that wouldn't have happened because they were worried about legitimating or reproducing the soft budget constraint. And there is work by Cottarelli and Coricelli and Blayer that argues that central banks in Eastern Europe actually refused the lender of last resort function even during banking crisis. The second discursive effect is to argue that state-owned banks just passively reproduce the soft budget constraint. However, if you look at research that documents the way that companies financed in Eastern Europe, the World Bank was arguing by 2002 that even small and medium enterprises had difficulties in accessing long-term finance, not to mention the large state-owned companies that by then were kind of disappearing, but that would have required access to bank lending. And that in a sense, hints towards the financialization of the banking sector, or the way that Bergloff and Bolton call it, the puzzle of financial development in transition. And I argue that the excess demand narrative is an important part of that, because Bergloff and Bolton say, well, this is very puzzling because we have this great divide, countries that did well, countries that had the wrong policies, but what comes at the end is a very similar financial architecture. And that financial architecture looks like this, financial system dominated by commercial banks, foreign-owned, lending to governments short-term, which for me it's a very clear description of this idea of the finance, impatient finance. And enterprises or companies were finding it difficult to finance from anything else but retained earnings, stock markets very illiquid and volatile, and then you had only foreign direct investment as the only source of external finance for companies. So for those of you who don't find neoliberalism as a too complicated term, this is, for me, a good description of the effects of neoliberalism in transition. So to conclude very quickly, I argued that excess demand narratives were crucial for translating the priorities of financialization. And in this paper, I define it through this idea of impatient finance that modifies the relationship between banking and industrial production into policy goals and practices. So we had a very important influence on how central banks conducted their liquidity policies. And the two key carriers of these were the IMF, but then also central banks. So the IMF's leveraging on the domestic policy scene depended very much on its ability to forge alliances with central banks. And we had the excess demand narrative arose from a heated debate before the collapse of communism related to the macroeconomics of planning, and that heated debate was collapsed into one hegemonic narrative that combined this equilibrium assumption of money neutrality with a shortage emphasis on soft budget constraints. And with a competing narrative that is controversial, we would have had a much stronger industrial structure sector that didn't depend so much on foreign direct investments, but would have represented national industrial capital. Okay, thank you. Sorry.
No, thank you very much indeed. You've the bit rate of your presentation was very high. You crammed an awful lot into 40 minutes. Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you.
I should have mentioned at the outset, by the way, that this talk is based on a paper that Daniela is publishing shortly.
In the April number of Review of Political Economy.
Yeah. So there'll be an opportunity to read it.
Yes.
Soon.
Yes.
Perhaps at this point, Michael, I could ask you to give your thoughts in response.
Right. Thank you very much. I'll adopt the usual discussant approach, which is to take for granted all the qualities of the paper, so that what I'm going to say may appear at some points to disagree with some features of the paper. It doesn't mean that I don't agree with very much of it. I want to make comments essentially under three headings. The first is just introductory. GDP per capita in Central and Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union dropped over 5 years between 89 and 95 by orders of magnitude which are astonishing. If you come west, the orders of magnitude are relatively small, for instance, Poland or Hungary or the Czech Republic. But as you go into the former Soviet Union itself, and particularly into its periphery, you get rates of collapse of around 70% in the smaller Caucasian places. So it's collapse, which is then followed by a phase of reconstruction, and then followed by a phase of vulnerability. There are two interpretations of the collapse. One centers on disruption and annihilation of a very complex input-output system of production, but basically disruption of production, together with disruption of the underlying financial system that essentially was the accounting side of that input-output system of production. The other interpretation is that this collapse has much to do with prescriptions which were adopted, for want of a better word, under the influence of the IMF. And that interpretation then says that the application of those prescriptions, particularly in the reconstruction period, made it vulnerable to recent events, as we've seen, and vulnerable all along. That's the interpretation, and Dr. Gabor has quite correctly brought out sort of three lessons which tend to support the disruption of production interpretation. One is the idea that stabilization to avoid collapse and rapid inflation and so on really required a certain amount of heterodox fixing of key benchmark prices, in particular the exchange rate, that it wasn't good enough, this is the second main point, to concentrate on what in Western terms would have been called the wage costs, because that was only a small part of the problem, and three, that it was urgent to attend to the credit needs of any reconstruction in production, and that wasn't taken care of because of what had happened in the financial system that underlies the system of production. So that's the introduction. I now want to make a very small historical observation on the IMF, and then I want to discuss the IMF programs, which is where possibly I'd be slightly more critical. I think it's silly to suppose that an institution like the IMF is particularly knowledgeable about anything in particular. In terms of centrally planned economies, the knowledge that existed until the late 80s was based on Yugoslavia, with which the IMF had had a long history of relationships, rather close relationships. And, of course, it's a mistake to suppose that Yugoslavia had anything to do with the Soviet-style centrally planned economies. What happened then is that in the late 80s, G7, I think they were at that time, invited the IMF, together with various other institutions, but the IMF acted as the leader, to essentially come up with an analysis of what was then the Soviet Union and what it could lead to. And this coincided with the sort of the tail end of the Latin American and other, the resolution of the tail end of the Latin American and other crises, which centers on the Brady Plan. And the IMF came up with a prescription for the USSR, which I consider highly questionable, which was that the USSR would be best cast in terms of a primary producer, which is, of course, a rather dangerous prescription given the amount of employment that there was in heavy industry at that point in the thing. But this was a very clear prescription which was adopted by the former Soviet Union, by Russia. It was basically Russia has recast itself together with its satellites as a primary producer. That made it very vulnerable in a lot of ways to a lot of subsequent disturbances. The satellites, with the exception of Yugoslavia, the IMF had zero experience of, and it operated in the dark. I'll give you only one example of this. It's well known that in the treatment of East Germany, there was a quarrel known as the coal-pearl quarrel between the Chancellor and the Bundesbank, and the IMF sided with the Chancellor as opposed to with the Bundesbank. The Bundesbank thought that the monetary unification would be a disaster, that it would basically bankrupt the East, and that is exactly what happened, essentially, because, but what is telltale about that is that in that, the IMF very explicitly sided with the federal government rather than with the Bundesbank, and that shows a sort of unfamiliarity bordering on complete ignorance of what the situation in a centrally planned economy was. Right? I now want to come to the IMF programs and to monetarism and what and the role that they play and where we can sort of agree on things. I think it's a mistake, and it's a mistake which incidentally is made at the IMF itself, so that the quote which you gave of by Allen and Haas is a very good example of how within the IMF the public version of its view of the world and of stabilization problems is at odds with the actual view of the institution. And so I would say that the Allen and Haas misunderstand rather fundamentally what an IMF program, how it works and what it's supposed to do. They do so for very good reasons, right? The history of the IMF prescription has had basically three stages. Initially, it was monetarist, and that was in the 50s to the middle 60s. And the view was that you controlled money in order to control inflation, in order to ginger up the growth rate. There was then a marked transition, and that orthodoxy ceased to be the correct view within the IMF, and it's not the way in which the IMF designs programs. The IMF uses the general price level, which has two components, basically public sector prices and the exchange rate, to control real consumption, which it sees as the key to controlling the growth rate of the economy. And then as an afterthought, and here Easterly is completely incorrect, as an afterthought, it reconstructs the monetary counterpart to that program. The program is adjust control public sector prices, adjust the exchange rate so as to control consumption, so as to control the growth rate, and then work backwards from ordinary monetary velocity figures and so on to what that implies for the program. The third stage is that post-Brady, the IMF was somewhat reluctantly brought into adding to this liberalization, privatization, deregulation, and all that sort of incantation. Right? Originally, its programs were actually associated with capital controls, which actually are controls on the banking system more than anything else. So that three-part evolution has resulted in the consensus which was then applied to these strange animals with which the IMF had no familiarity whatever, right? I'm tempted to say if a drunk drops his money in the dark, right, he doesn't look for it where he's dropped it. He goes to look for it under the lamppost because that's where you can see. Mm-hmm. And the IMF did exactly the same thing in relation to Eastern Europe, as indeed it had done in relation to the East Asian crisis just a little bit afterwards. And mm-hmm. It applied a tried formula, which, as I explained, is not very well understood within the institution itself. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that in a mocking way. I'm saying mm-hmm. it much more in a sort of analytical way. I think people like Easterly, and actually I'm sorry to say Alan and Haas, don't exactly understand how these programs work. They can be blamed in a variety of ways. Where I would completely agree with you, and I want to finish with that, is in terms of what really seems to have gone wrong and where we the whole thing is a bit of a tragic exercise. I should say that in about half the countries that have been affected in this story, the per capita standard of living has not recovered its level in 1989, 1990. Right? I think the first thing which is sort of very clear, and where I'd really agree with what you've said, is that working capital needs, which is what the banking system generates, are essential to production. And although in the Soviet system, working capital needs were intermittently met by inter-entity credit, inter-business credit, this is a very insecure form of credit provision, so that as the financial system shrank, what appears to have happened is that the banks shrank with it, right? And therefore availability of working capital wasn't there. Another problem is that the life cycle, which is basically all the way from financing the early part to, in particular, financing the late part, which is a very important part of the design of a financial system, was completely unattended to. Right? And so Porters and others neglected this. They thought the financial system equals the banks. Right? But in fact, the financial system is insurance companies, pension funds, and so on, all the chaps who are supposed to pick up the state assets when you privatize them. Mm-hmm. So there we would agree entirely, right? I also agree that once the system got into trouble, credit to enterprises became deeply unattractive to what was left of a shrinking banking system, right? Because it was very risky, enterprises didn't pay each other, and so on. So it was a very wrong formula. The third thing that I think I agree with you, right, is that it was a big mistake to not observe primitive sequencing in terms of reforms, institutions first, then a little bit of internal pricing, and lastly, the exchange rate and capital movements. In fact, in the most disastrous cases, it was done in exactly the reverse order. And so that the institutions started to appear after. So it's always very challenging. This is a tragic episode. And it's useful to think about it again.
Thank you very much indeed.